So far in our study of the Ark of the Covenant, we have touched upon some of its many movements. We saw, first of all, that the Ark was made at Mount Sinai, according to instructions given to Moses, and it was fashioned by Bezaleel and Aholiab. Then we saw that the Ark accompanied Israel throughout her wilderness wanderings for the next 40 or so years. The Ark then led Israel across the River Jordan and into the Promised Land. Last week, we considered the fall of Jericho and the Ark's encircling the walls 13 times. And then, at the shout, the blast of the trumpet, the walls came tumbling down. Now, before I come to our text this morning in 1 Samuel chapter 4, I want to fill in some other details that take us from Joshua 6 up to 1 Samuel 4, some of the further movements of the Ark in the intervening years. In Joshua chapter 7, the chapter after that we studied last week, we see Joshua falling down in prayer to the Lord before the Ark of the Covenant because Israel has just been defeated in her first battle with Ai. Because, as you'll remember, Achan took of the accursed things. In the very next chapter, Joshua chapter 8, the Ark was placed between the tribes in the valley that divided the twin mountains of Mount Ebal and Gerizim, when the blessings and curses were uttered. Then, with the removal of the tabernacle from Gilgal, which was Israel's first camp on this side of the Jordan, with the removal of the tabernacle from Gilgal to Shiloh, the Ark was there stationed for some 300 plus years. Judges 20 verse 27, the only reference to the Ark in that book. Judges 20 verse 27 speaks of the Ark, and if you compare this with Judges 21 verses 2, 12 and 19, the Ark was at Shiloh. And the Ark here is still at Shiloh with the tabernacle and the priesthood in the time of our text in 1 Samuel 4 and verse 1. Later though, in this chapter, the Ark is captured. It falls into the hands of the enemy, Philistine hands, and this is perhaps the lowest point in the history of the Ark of the Covenant, except perhaps the fall of Jerusalem itself. Let's consider then the Ark is captured. First, how it happened. Second, how Eli reacted. And third, how Phinehas' wife was affected. The Ark is captured. How it happened, how Eli reacted, and how Phinehas' wife was affected. Now our story opens with the first of two battles between Israel and the Philistines in verses 1 and 2. This battle took place in the 40th and last year of Eli's time as judge, and Eli was also the high priest. The location of the battle is some ways to the north of the five great cities of the Philistines in southwest Palestine near Aphek, according to verse 1. Now Samson, if you will remember, the last judge before Eli, Samson seemed unable to get the nation as a whole to fight against the Philistines. He would fight against them, and God would give him an occasion to fight against them. And in one instance, when the Philistines came into Israel to get Samson, rather than the Israelites joining with Samson to fight the Philistines, the Israelites went to Samson and said, "Can we hand you over?" So in Samson's day as a judge, and he was judge for 20 years, he couldn't get Israel to unite as a nation against the Philistines. And yet here, in 1 Samuel 4 verses 1 and 2, Israel is now arrayed as a nation against her old enemy. This raises the question, why now has there been this change of heart? Not a radical change of heart, they haven't repented as we'll see, but now at least they're willing to fight the armies of the Philistines. It could be that the power of the Philistines has waned somewhat, and Israel recognizes they're not as strong as they used to be. Maybe now's our chance. It could be that after the passage of many years, they've finally got fed up with being in subjection to the Philistines, and so they're ready to try to revolt. It could also be as verse 1 may suggest, it could also be that now that they see that God has given them a great prophet, Samuel, who was the greatest figure in Israel since the death of Joshua over 300 years before, it could be that now they think our fortunes are going to change. Maybe now is the time for us to fight back. Whether it was that Israel came to be on that battlefield as a nation, they left it in disarray, and 4,000 of them didn't leave it at all. Now, when the defeated Israelites come back to the camp, the post-mortem immediately begins. What went wrong? What happened? The elders ask the pressing question in verse 3, "Wherefore hath the Lord smitten us today before the Philistines?" They're asking this question. Why? Why did this happen? We're the people of the Lord. We're supposed to win all the time. What's gone wrong? And especially are they asking, what is Jehovah doing in all this? They understand that Jehovah allowed this to happen. Nay, Jehovah himself smote them. Notice the question. Wherefore hath the Lord smitten us before the Philistines? Israel thereby shows that she understands that she lost the battle not on military grounds, but on religious grounds. The elders of Israel don't sit together and discuss, well, what about the weaponry? Maybe they had better armaments than we did. Maybe that's what turned the battle. Maybe our strategy was wrong. Maybe if we had attacked from a different location, or if we had more numbers, maybe we could have won that way. They don't bother in any military discussion at all. They understand that it is religious. In fact, they affirm that it isn't even so much the Philistines that smote them, it was the Lord who smote them by means of the Philistines. That's the question. Wherefore hath the Lord smitten us today? He smote us, and he smote us before the Philistines. So far, so good. Now, formally, Israel is asking the right question. Wherefore hath the Lord smitten us before the Philistines? Formally, but not in reality, she's asking the right question. Her answer, though, is completely wrong. The answer to her question, why did we lose this battle, is very simple. It would have stared any right-thinking Israelite in the face. She lost the battle because she sinned. It doesn't take a genius to work that out. This is the reason why all the people of God individually and collectively suffer spiritual defeats. We sin. That's why we lose. We sin. Very simple. Leviticus 26, verse 14 and verse 17 say, "But if ye will not hearken unto me," God is speaking, "and will not do all these commandments, I will set my face against you, and ye shall be slain before your enemies." If any of the children had been catechized and remembered their lessons at all, and had strayed into the camp, one of them could have voiced up and said, "I know why we lost. It says in Leviticus that if we don't obey God, he'll cause us to be smitten before our enemies." Very simple. But Israel, in the blindness of her sin, didn't really want to know the real reason for her defeat. She didn't say, "What does God's word say? What about reading Leviticus 26 or Deuteronomy 28 or any of the other passages?" She didn't say, "Well, look, we've got a prophet in the land. We could go and ask Samuel, and Samuel will tell us." They didn't even raise the issue. Maybe we should repent. Maybe we should all humble ourselves and seek God's face, as Joshua did in Joshua 7 after they lost the first battle with the people of Ai. And they didn't ask these questions because, as 1 Samuel 7 verses 3 and 4 indicates, that Israel at this time was worshipping Baal and Ashtaroth, the gods of the Canaanites. So they come into battle, and we're the Lord's people, and we're going to fight his battles. But all the while they're worshipping Baal and Ashtaroth, and that's their problem, and that's why they don't face the issue head on. Israel here wanted deliverance from her enemies without repentance and without obedience to the Lord. So it is that Israel seeks help in a superstitious use of the ark. The question's asked, "Wherefore hath the Lord smitten us today before the Philistines?" Here's the answer, without any other possible answers even seeming to have been raised, immediately comes out this answer, well, let's get the ark. Then we win. Let us fetch the ark of the covenant of the Lord out of Shiloh unto us, that when it cometh among us, it may save us out of the hand of our enemies. This teaches us that Israel's religion at this time consisted merely in holy things. Holy things. And that's superstition. We're looking to the ark of the Lord, but they're not looking to the Lord of the ark. And so the ark here is treated by the Israelites as a religious thing, a holy item. And it, verse 3, let us fetch the ark of the covenant out of Shiloh unto us, that when it cometh among us, it may save us out of the hand of our enemies. It, this holy thing. If only we had another holy thing in the midst of us, we'd win all our battles. That simple. Israel's religion consisted in holy things. Her religion consisted in holy things without holy hearts. That's superstition. Her religion consisted in holy things carried by unholy hands. Who brought this ark? Verse 4 says, Hophni and Phinehas. And what sort of men were Hophni and Phinehas? Chapter 2, verse 12 says, they were sons of Belial who knew not the Lord. They weren't even believers. They were worshippers of idols. These men, according to chapter 2, verses 13 to 17, were thieves. Thieves who stole from the Lord's offerings. That's the sort of men you're dealing with. These men were fornicators. When women would come up to the tabernacle to worship the Lord, then they would sleep with the women outside the tabernacle. This was Israel's religion. If we can get holy things, we don't care if they're carried with unholy hands. We don't care if our hearts and lives are unworthy and profane. Then God will be forced by some magical trick to cause us to beat the hated Philistines. Their religion, therefore, consisted in holy things carried by unholy hands for a people with unholy hearts, and that, if you want it, is as good a definition of superstition as you can get. And superstition is idolatry. And of course it's idolatry. They're worshipping idols, and then when they need a little bit of Jehovah worship, then their Jehovah worship is itself idolatry. This superstition, too, was the religion of both leaders and people. In verse 3, the leaders suggest this superstition. When the people were coming to the camp, the elders of Israel said, why has the Lord smitten us? Let us fetch the ark. And then the people readily agree, verse 4, so the people sent to Shiloh that they may bring from thence the ark of the covenant. No reference to a dissenting voice. And while God's ark is abused as a fetish or a magic talisman, they hope that God will give them victory over the Philistines. Now, most of the professing church world today is no better than superstitious Israel. In the 21st century, statues of the Virgin Mary are carried about in street processions by ungodly priests before adoring crowds. This happens in various parts of the world, in the Roman Catholic Church, in Spain, in Malta, Southern Europe, South America, in Africa, in Asia, all over the world. It happens in the Church of England. They have a big procession when the Virgin Mary in an idol is carried before the adoring masses in Walsingham, in England. For most people in the professing Christian church, baptism is viewed as a magical rite. And if that water in baptism hits you, then you are automatically regenerated. That's what most people who name the name of Christ think of baptism. Sheer superstition. If you watch a sporting event and there's a substitution, say in soccer, many of those coming on will cross themselves as if that may help them to score a goal or play well. Superstition. You see people in prayer or in times of distress handling a crucifix as if that will add a little bit of oomph to their prayers, and then God will hear them. In many homes, take the island of Ireland, religious pictures are treated as holy relics, mere talismans to fend off evil. And this is no different from an outright pagan wearing a rabbit's foot on a chain around his neck. No different. In fact, some of these people, they have their holy relics, Bibles and pictures, maybe a crucifix on around their neck, and maybe a rabbit's foot there as well. No principal difference. Sheer superstition. And even here, in a Reformed church, we need to avoid this superstition. The thinking that because we have Christian items in our midst, that thereby we don't need to live and believe the true gospel of Christ and walk worthy of our calling. Our baptism form, therefore, warns against using the sacrament out of superstition. The Lord's Supper form exhorts us not to cleave to the external elements of bread and wine, but to lift up our hearts where Jesus Christ sits at the right hand of God. Because the Reformed Fathers don't want any idolatry or superstition in the sacraments. And we today can't waive the three forms of unity, our Heidelberg Catechism and Belgic Confession and Synod of Dort, as if this were like a ticket to heaven. Look, this is our confession and we have these creeds. Good to have those creeds. But the question is, do you believe from the heart the form of doctrine set forth on the basis of the Bible? That's the heart of it. You can't even say, well, I'm a member of a Reformed church, and so God must be pleased with me. And our church teaches the truth, and ours is a pretty good church, you know. That's no good in itself, because you must receive what you are taught and believe it and obey it, or else it's just another form of superstition and fetish. You must look to Jesus Christ alone, taught in this church, and typified by the ark. And then Christ crucified alone. He is our help, and he is our shield. Trusting in that, then we say, what have we to do with idols? We don't want superstition, because we have the reality. Christ himself as the Son of God and head of the church. In some time past, the battle goes on in the hearts and minds of the people. The messengers from Israel's camp beside Ebenezer get to Shiloh, and the ark traverses the 20-odd miles, fair distance, to Israel's camp. The ark is greeted with great joy by the Israelites as it comes into their midst. Verse 5, when the ark of the covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted with a great shout, so that the earth rang again. Universal rejoicing. Everybody shouting. And we ought to understand, too, that this great shout ought to be understood as a sort of battle cry. Because we're talking of a shout made by an army, the army of Israel. Made by them in their camp. Made by them as they anticipate success in their next battle with the Philistines. And so this cry is designed to encourage themselves for the battle and to demoralize their enemy. That's a battle cry. And it's striking, too, how excited Israel could become with their superstitious use of the ark. Oh, look, it's going to deliver us. That was their superstition, and they could whip up all sorts of enthusiasm for their superstition. And this enthusiasm, too, characterizes much of the false church as they dote upon their idols and superstitions and relics. You may have seen some of these people. How they can get excited about a religious picture and how they love their rosary and all their traditions. And you say, maybe there's something to this because those people are all really excited and they seem so pious. Not a bit of it. Israel here got all excited when they brought their superstitions into the camp. Now Israel shouted, and the Philistines heard Israel's great shout. Whether it was through scouts or some other means, they ascertained the reason for this shout was that the ark had now come into the camp of their enemy. And their initial reaction to this is fear. They were scared. They were scared because somehow or other they associated the ark with the divine presence. God is come into the camp. And that can only be a terrifying thing for these idolaters. They were afraid too because this was unprecedented. In all the warfare between Israel and the Philistines to this point, the ark had never been involved. And so now they say, "Woe unto us, for there hath not been such a thing heretofore." And then too, the Philistines knew something of the ark's previous victories. So in verse 7 and in verse 8, they cry out, "Woe, woe unto us, woe unto us. God has come. It's never been before. This ark, it always seems to win them victories. We're done for." They're afraid. Did you notice, though, that the Philistines' knowledge of the true religion is garbled? The Philistines were off in their theology. Verse 7, they say, "God is come into the camp." Here, these pagans have a similar idea as idolaters themselves. They could easily understand the idea of holy thing, then the divine fights for you. But they fell into the same mistake as the unbelieving church. They were also not only off in their theology, but in their history. I'm going to quote verse 8. Now think about verse 8 as I read it. "Woe unto us, who shall deliver us out of the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods that smote the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness." First thing, the ark was not with Israel in Egypt. The ark was only made on Mount Sinai. So the ark had nothing to do with the plagues upon the Egyptians. Secondly, the Egyptians were not smitten with plagues in the wilderness. The Egyptians didn't get to the wilderness. The Egyptians drowned in the Dead Sea. The Egyptians were smitten with plagues in Egypt. "These are the gods that smote the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness." 300 or 400 years have passed. The Philistines never really got the story straight. It was all some sort of garbled tradition in their mind. Now verse 9, we've earlier spoken of the Philistines' fear. Verse 9, though, especially emphasizes the pride of the Philistines. There are three main things that speak of these people being proud. They exhort themselves twice in verse 9, "Quit yourselves like men. Tighten your belt, you're men. Now be proud and fight as men, and don't let yourselves down." And then secondly, they say, "Quit yourselves like men, that ye be not servants unto the Hebrews." Now look, we've ruled over them and they've been their servants and they've been our servants, and that's the way it ought to be, because they're just Hebrews and we are the Philistines. Now, better off fight and die than be the servants to that lot over there. And then a third instance of their pride is seen in this. They say in verse 7, "God has come into the camp." God is with them, whatever that meant in their minds. And then they decide, "Let's fight." They're going to fight against God, as they have expressed it themselves. Now, if you think you could fight against God and win, you must be very proud. Now, this second battle with the Philistines, Israel fights and loses. The results recorded in verses 10 and 11. They lost the battle, and they did worse than previously. And they did worse than previously, even though they had the ark with them. Let's compare the two battles. With this second battle, there's a larger number of dead Israelites. 4,000 died for the first time, now 30,000 dies. 7 times as much, and more. And this second time, they are also routed. You note from verse 3 that after the first battle, when they lost 4,000, the Israelites were able to return to the camp, and then they were able to fight another day. After the second battle, verse 10 tells us, they fled every man into his tent. They didn't come back to the camp at Aphek. They all scattered, and Israel completely left the field defeated and humiliated. So I say, even with the ark, they lost over 7 times as many men, and they were routed and completely defeated. And then also, they lost the ark. And Hophni and Phinehas, number 2 and number 3 in the religious order of Israel, as the sons of the high priest, they were slain. Now, a couple of points ought to be underscored here. First of all, this shows to us the vanity of superstition. This superstitious use of the ark did not save Israel. The superstitious use of the ark merely incurred a greater divine judgment. 30,000 die now, and they were routed. So it is too with the false church. Her superstition and idolatry doesn't save her either. It merely increases her damnation. That's what superstition does. And then second, in this defeat of Israel, and especially the death of Hophni and Phinehas, the two priests, we see here the fulfillment of prophecy. A man of God came to Eli at the end of chapter 2. Part of his prophecy was this, verse 34. This shall be a sign unto thee, that shall come upon thy two sons, on Hophni and Phinehas. In one day they shall die, both of them. And that's what happened. Let's consider now how Eli reacted. Eli, by this stage, is old, overweight, and almost blind. And an old, overweight, almost blind man is not going to journey 20 miles to the battlefield. He stays at home. Staying at home, though, Eli was deeply concerned for the ark. In fact, verse 13 says, his heart trembled for the ark of God. So Eli is presented to us in verse 13 as waiting anxiously, watching out for news of the battle. Verse 13 says that Eli sat upon a seat by the wayside watching. A seat here is literally the seat. And this is probably the same seat which was by the post of the tabernacle, mentioned in chapter 1, verse 29. The seat that Eli sat on. Maybe his favorite seat. And now Eli, so keen to hear the news, he asked some of his friends and associates to move his seat some way down the path so that he could wait to hear news of the battle and especially of the ark. Now Eli's heart trembled for the ark. Why? First of all, we need to say that though Eli was overindulgent with his two sons, chapters 2 and 3 deal with this, though he was overindulgent with his two sons, he was a godly man. He loved the Lord, and he loved, therefore, the visible token of his presence, the Ark of the Covenant. Eli was also a priest who labored in the tabernacle at Shiloh, and he understood the significance of this Ark. That it symbolized God, the justice of God, because in the Ark we have the Ten Commandments, which reveal our duty because of God's holiness and justice. And he understood too that the ark spoke of divine mercy, because atop the ark was the mercy seat. He understood that God himself spoke of his justice and mercy from the ark. And that's what Eli, as a believing child of God, knew the ark to mean. Now, the Roman Catholic Church, and I quoted from this last week, the Roman Catholic Church sees the ark as a picture and type of Mary. They argue that just as the ark housed the Ten Commandments, the law, Mary housed in her womb during her pregnancy, the lawgiver, Jesus Christ himself. So what's applied to the ark, they then apply to the Virgin Mary. So according to that reasoning, Eli would have trembled for the ark because it foreshadowed the glory of the Virgin Mary. Not a bit of it. Eli also trembled for the ark because he was the high priest. And as the high priest, for many years, remember he's 98, for many years he alone, out of all the thousands and millions of Israel, he alone was permitted to go into the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement to sprinkle blood on and before the mercy seat. He understood that this typified the blood of the Messiah, which was shed for all Israel's sins. And he's thinking to himself, what a terrible thing it would be if we lost this ark. The very center of the worship as instituted by God at Sinai. The very heart of my work as high priest and a picture of the propitiation of the sins of God's people. We could lose this in this battle. And then the ark would fall into the hands of the Philistines. And Eli, he's trembling for the ark. And he's trembling for the ark too, because he knows Israel's sin. See, when Joshua fought, we looked at this last week, at Jericho, the ark was involved. And he wasn't trembling for the ark. He knew that God had promised they would take the land, and they were with God. But Eli here, he knows that Israel is walking in sin. He knows that God could justly cause Israel to lose this battle and forfeit the ark itself. He knew that they were idolaters. He knew that Baal and Ashtaroth were worshipped in the land of Israel. He knew also that many Israelites abhorred the offering of the Lord. Chapter 2, verse 17. The sacrifices which were offered at the tabernacle in Shiloh. He knew that many people in Israel despised it, wouldn't even come. And the heart of that was the Ark of the Covenant. They despised all the offerings. They doubtless despised the offering on the Day of Atonement too. And he knew too that the ungodliness and fornications and robberies of his sons played a large part in the reason why your average Israelite despised the worship of God. Because when they came up to offer sacrifices, the priests slept with their women and stole part of the sacrifices to feed their own bellies. And he says, well, God could take the ark from us because we're walking in disobedience. Perhaps the worst sting in Eli's conscience, though, was this. Eli trembled for the ark because he knew his own sin. And he was the high priest. Eli understood, because Samuel brought the word of God to him in chapter 3, verse 13, that God was angry with him personally because he did not sufficiently rebuke his sons. And chapter 2, verse 29 says that Eli even partook of the meat which his sons stole from the Lord's offering. He was going to eat with his sons, and they're taking some of this meat. And so when he visits with them, chapter 2, verse 29 says, wherefore kick ye at my sacrifice, the man of God here says to Eli, and at mine offering which I have commanded in my habitation, and honorest thy sons above me, to make yourselves fat with the chiefest of all the offerings of Israel, my people, to make yourselves fat. That was part of the reason why Eli was so heavy. He ate some of this food. That's why he was trembling for the ark too. We could lose the knowledge of God in our land because of our sin. Now, in the early 1600s in Bohemia, now the Czech Republic, 90% of the country was Protestant, either Hussite, Lutheran, or Reformed. 90% was Protestant. And then the King of Bohemia and the Holy Roman Empire was a Jesuit, or rather a Roman Catholic, who was under the influence of the Jesuits. Within a few years, he had killed the Protestants and the Christian school teachers and many of the leaders and nobility and expelled others. Within many years, it was 90% Roman Catholic. This is the bit I want to get to. One of those Bohemian noblemen, before he was executed in Prague, said, this all came upon us because we were ungrateful. We had the gospel of Christ and we esteemed it lightly and thought of it always, and we weren't thankful. And then God sent this wicked king as a scourge upon us. That's why they lost the ark. They weren't grateful. John Bradford, going back another century in England, John Bradford had this to say. He was a martyr killed by bloody Queen Mary. He said, Lord, it was my unthankfulness for the gospel that brought in popery in Queen Mary's days, and my unfruitfulness under the gospel that was the cause of the untimely death of godly King Edward the VI. The ark was lost, these men are saying, because of the sins of the church, and especially the sin of ingratitude. Grateful, and think lightly of the privileges that we have, then we ought to start trembling, because then God takes away the ark, and then we're lost without the knowledge of God, especially in our generations. Now, while Eli was trembling, this messenger from the battlefield, the soldier, who we're told was of the tribe of Benjamin, he comes running to Shiloh. 20-odd miles, must have been a fit man. First, he comes to the town of Shiloh. So the tabernacle, we would guess, was a bit to the east of Shiloh. He comes to the town of Shiloh with his news. His garments are torn, and he has dust upon his head, and the town cries out in anguish and grief. And Eli, though he's blind, and the text actually says that his eyes were fixed, presumably had some problem with the nerves in his eyes, so he couldn't focus, and so he couldn't see too well. Though he was blind, he wasn't deaf, and he heard this cry. And he thought to himself, surely this must be a bad sign. And then the messenger reaches Eli himself, and he's panting as well he might be. He's panting. And so he expresses himself to Eli in short, sharp sentences. Eli, I'm he that came out of the army, and I'm fled today out of the army. And Eli says to him, what has done, my son? What's happened on the battlefield? And the messenger then utters four short, hard hammer blows, with each one worse than the preceding. Israel has fled from the Philistines, and there has been a great slaughter among the people, and thy two sons also, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead. And then maybe he paused a bit longer, and he added finally, and the ark of God taken. Which of these four things hit Eli hardest? Eli was an Israelite. The first statement was, Israel has fled before the Philistines. That would have hit him hard. Eli was a judge. And the next line is, there hath also been a great slaughter among the people. And that would have hit him hard. Eli was a father. Thy two sons also, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead. And he wouldn't have liked that either. But it was the last one that really got him. And the ark of God is taken. And verse 18 highlights this. And it came to pass, when he made mention of the ark of God, that he fell from off the seat backward by the side of the gate, and his neck brake, and he died. For he was an old man and heavy, and he had judged Israel 40 years. Now, which one of those things would hit you hardest? Say there was a war. None of us would like to hear of a war that we were involved in, that forces of Northern Ireland and the United Kingdom are being mobilized to fight some enemy. Some natural disaster hits Northern Ireland. With us, I suppose, it's most likely to be some sort of terrible flood. Or your children die. All your children. In one day. Eli, though his heart wasn't hard, Eli was gravely affected by those things, as he ought to be. And he was pious in being affected by those things. But Eli was supremely affected by this. The ark. That's even worse. And each one of us ought to follow the example of godly Eli and to be more affected by the loss of the gracious presence of God in his church than even a disaster happening to our nation, even the death of all your children in one day. And this is what the head of the Christian religion taught when he said that we must not rate father or mother or children or brother or sister or anything more highly than him, the ark. When he heard that, what was the point in living anymore? In 98, he's seen a lot of apostles saying this was the crowning event. The ark's gone. He just gave up the ghost, fell backwards, and died. And there was another death on that day too. A death which also coincided with the birth of a new life. Phinehas was mine. And though an ungodly, wicked priest, Phinehas' wife was a godly woman. How she put up with that man and his stealing from the offerings of God and his fornication at the temple when it was a scandal throughout all of the country. It was a tribute to her piety that she could put up with that and not divorce him. Phinehas' wife, this godly woman, she's been pregnant for about 9 months. And she was there too with her father-in-law. And she heard that the ark was taken. That was the main thing with her too. And of course, now her father-in-law has died, this godly high priest of the land. That's an additional blow. More important to her, actually, even than her own husband. This brought upon her labor. The 29th Psalm, we looked at it a few weeks ago. The voice of the Lord coming in a thunderstorm. One of the things that the voice of the Lord did in that thunderstorm in Psalm 29 was that it caused the hinds to calve. They were scared, and they gave birth. And this terrible news brought upon her childbirth. She enters into labor, and the women who were by her, midwives, friends, said, "Don't fear, don't fear. Look, you've got a healthy boy, a little son." And she's so taken by the death of the high priest, and especially the loss of the ark, and you could add to that the death of her husband, that she does a totally unnatural thing. Doesn't even speak to the person who's told her about the birth of the child. Doesn't even look at the child. That's a really unnatural thing. She'd been looking forward, no doubt, to the birth of this child for the 9 months of her pregnancy. The child comes out, and somebody says, "What are you going to call it?" Because the decision now is in her hands, because her husband's dead, wholly in her hands. One word, Ichabod. The word kabod in Hebrew means glory. Ichabod means where is the glory, or even a negative. There is no glory. The glory's departed from Israel. We've lost the ark. The priest, the high priest, dead. My husband's gone. The glory is departed from Israel. But the ark of God is taken. That little boy had the name of Ichabod from the day of his birth and all through his life. He was a testimony to the day that Israel lost the ark because of their superstition, because of their idolatry. And that was a deeply, deeply humbling day. And the Church of Christ now must be wary. We don't want to lose the ark. We don't want to fall into idolatry or superstition or ingratitude. But we must esteem the ark, the presence of God in Jesus Christ, for mercy, the way Phinehas' wife did, the way Eli did. And we must too tremble at any sign of the ark may be departing.